Well, as I mentioned earlier, we have a few among us who heard the sermon I'm going to give today last week. I'm sorry about that. I'll tell you a little story about my beginning in the ministry as a trainee in Chicago before getting into the sermon. And it ties in with listening to the same sermon again and again and again and again. My job as a trainee, February 1961 in Chicago, I went from sunny Pasadena to snowstorms and below zero weather in Chicago as a trainee. And I worked with Dean Blackwell, Hal Baird, and John Bald. Mr. Blackwell was the minister in charge of the area, big area. And I usually was the one that drove the car. And it was about 130 miles from Chicago to Milwaukee, 130 miles from Chicago south to Bloomington, Illinois, and about 130 miles from Chicago east to South Bend, Indiana. So on Friday night, I drove to Chicago, and I listened to Dean Blackwell give the sermon in Milwaukee. And then I drove home, and Sunday, and then we had Sabbath services Sabbath morning, and then we'd drive from Chicago south to Bloomington, Illinois, about 130 miles, and I drove, and I listened to the sermon again by Dean Blackwell, the same sermon. Then, I listened to him in Chicago, and so that's three times I heard the same sermon in 2 days. And then Sunday morning, we drove all the way over to Elkhart. I drove, and guess who gave the sermon again? Dean Blackwell. So have you ever listened to the same minister give the same sermon four times in a weekend? And you sat up with a smile on your face, and you're just absorbing every word? Well, I tell you, honestly, after driving, and we'd usually get home at 1 in the morning, so I was a little sleepy by Saturday afternoon, Sunday morning. And so the last sermon, I usually had to force myself to sit up straight and listen very, very well, or I might be doing this during the sermon, at least in the fourth one. Just thought I'd give you that interesting story about listening to the same sermon by the same man four times. Who knows? Maybe I needed it. It'll sound like when I start that I'm talking about success, but I want to use the word success. To many people, success seems like a mystery. How in the world can you be successful? I've thought about it, they say, but I don't know how you are. In truth, success really isn't a mystery. Success involves good decisions, good habits, and hard work. But it also involves one other thing, which doesn't seem to just normally and naturally either appeal to us or become a part of our way of thinking. Successful people, that is, people who are, shall we say, genuinely successful, have two habits that help them in becoming a successful person. And one of them is they have a long-term view of life. Now, you've heard the expression instant gratification. You've heard the term short-term view. Short-term means they're not looking very far beyond their nose. Long-term means they have just that, a long-term view of life, of your job, of many other things. Successful people have a long-term view of life and how to live it. Two, people who are successful know that any endeavor has guidelines to follow. And this is one of the hard things of life. Any endeavor has guidelines to follow, and that to be successful, you have to be willing to live by those guidelines. If you're not, you may just have to pull up stakes and go here and then go again and go again and go again, because no matter where we go, we're going to find that there are rules we have to live by. I won't say God's law, but there will be rules, and to some people, their rules are God's law. So, two things that help in making us successful is having a long-term view of life and how to live it, and to understand in our heart that any endeavor has guidelines to follow, and we have to learn to live by those guidelines. You may have not ever looked at yourself as what we call a futuristic person, but you are. You are a futuristic person, and that means that we do look out into the future. So that being the case, let me ask you this question. We all make decisions, good and bad. And when we make decisions, how far ahead do we look? Now that may mean, well, how far ahead do I have to look? But how far ahead do we look? Or ask in another way, how far ahead should we look? One day, 1 week, 1 month, 1 year, 10 years? A generation, which, what's that, 30, 40 years? Dare we look forward 100 years? You know, there are people who are still attending the Church of God today who in the 60s were told it's all going to be up in 72. And even though you need your teeth repaired, no reason to do it because time's going to be over and you won't need to do that. How far ahead were they looking? In 69, that was only 3 years. A generation? Dare we look 100 years? How about 1,000? In making your decisions, dare we ever look 1,000 years ahead of the time of now? And in addition to how far we look ahead, do we consider only ourselves, which is usually called selfishness, or do we consider others who will follow in our footsteps? Some years ago, just before the Feast of Tabernacles, I went over to Downers Grove, Illinois, which is just inside Cook County, not all that far away from Indiana. I lived in Crown Point, Indiana at the time. And I went over there to get an I-Pass for the Illinois toll road travel. And I really was glad I did, because later the Indiana toll road accepted the Illinois toll road icon. And when there was 5 or 10 or 15, 18-wheelers backing up traffic, I just whizzed right on by in the other lane, and they accepted my I-Pass, and it really did make travel nice on the interstate, and especially in Chicago. It really did. So I'd gone over there to get an I-Pass for the toll road in Illinois, and I noticed I was going down Ogden Street to get wherever I went, and I noticed Trader Joe's. Trader Joe's is an ice store. Lily and I lived in South Pasadena for 6 months in 1970 when we were on sabbatical, and we had shopped at Trader Joe's in Pasadena at that time. I think mostly it was about wine, alcohol. They had a lot of alcohol. We bought some wine. Two Buck Chuck. Yeah, they have one called Two Buck Chuck. Charles Schwab, I think it is. He has promised all of his wine to Costco, and you can get a really, really nice bottle of Merlot for $2 if you live in California. But if you live in Indiana or some other place, you got to pay the shipping, which is $1 or $2. But still, it's less expensive than other wine. So we had been drinking some of two-buck chuck wine in those days, so I thought I'd stop at Trader Joe's and see what they had. And I was cruising up and down the lines in the store, and all of a sudden I stopped at the soap and detergent station or section. One box especially caught my attention because of the label. The label said, and I think I still have that label, seventh generation laundry detergent. I thought, what a strange name for a box of soap powder. Seventh generation laundry detergent. Why was it called seventh generation? Well, it was certified to be free of various chemicals in order not to harm or pollute the ecology. It wouldn't harm the streams, the rivers, the lakes, or water. So in producing that product, they were looking forward to the ecology of our nation and our world. And they were thinking about not polluting the water, which was thinking about those who drink that water. And it did catch my attention, and I bought it. That is, I bought the idea, and I also bought the box. On the box was a quote from the Great Law of the Iroquois Indian Confederation. And it was that quote that stopped me dead in my tracks. Because the quote out of the Great Law of the Iroquois Indian Confederation said, quote, "In our every deliberation," meaning decision, "in our every deliberation, we must consider the impact of our decisions on the next seven generations." What a powerful statement. That when we make a decision, we are thinking, what impact will this bring on my children, my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren, my great-great-grandchildren? How will this affect my genealogy? How will this affect future generations? It seems very few people think that. Talk about long term. That was a very, very profound statement. Well, my sermon is not about laundry detergent, but it was what brought up the idea. We have a lot of problems in the USA and in the world, and often in discussing, talking about our national, international problems, either from the personal viewpoint or the group viewpoint, you will hear the word generational. Generational. That is, the effects of past actions, whatever they may be, are passed along from generation to generation to generation to generation. I'm sure you've heard that. None of us wants to admit that maybe we have even had a part in making that happen. But we know it has happened. It is happening. It does happen. The effects of past actions are passed along from generation to generation. What a pity that my children will be affected by my decisions. But even though it's a pity, it is true. Teen pregnancy, often you'll find it's generational. My mama got pregnant. I got pregnant. My kid got pregnant. Drug abuse. An example I remember reading about, there was a man who was a severe alcoholic. He had two twin sons, and some 20 years later, they were interviewed by a reporter magazine about why they were the way they were. One, both had grown up under an alcoholic father. One was an alcoholic. The other was a teetotaler. I mentioned that word to somebody recently, and they said, "What's a teetotaler?" Well, good. I'm glad they didn't know the meaning of it. But one was an alcoholic. The other didn't drink alcohol at all. And when asked, the first one was asked, well, why did you turn out to be an alcoholic? And the answer was, with an old man like I had, what do you expect me to be like? So they asked the second one, who didn't drink at all, why are you as you are? And he said, with an old man like I had, what do you expect me to be like? So there was an impact on the lives of each, even though they were different. But the point is, our decisions do affect those that follow in our steps. And we need to understand it, not out of fear, because there's always the positive side. But it's called generational. Generational. And there's a reason why it's generational. Teen pregnancy, drug abuse, men who better their wives, welfare programs. Some families just don't seem to be able to escape the welfare mentality. Debt of all kinds. It is passed along from one generation to the other to max out your credit card. That's just the way life is. We influence them by what we do. How many people's lives have been affected by the decisions of those who went before them? Mine has been. I can look at my life and see things from my early youth that were as a direct result of the decisions and lifestyle of my parents. They were good parents, but they made some decisions on some things, some of it because of the Great Depression. Some of it, I don't know all the reasons. My wife grew up in a family of divorcees, and she just assumed that's the way all the world was. Well, I grew up, I'm the eighth of nine. There was no divorce in my family, immediate family. There has been since. So I assumed the whole world was the way my family was, but she assumed the whole world was the way her family style was. So we had a little bit of a different view of things. But it was generational. I'm sure many in this room have, if they look at it objectively, not negatively, but just objectively, realize there are things in their life that are that way because of the decisions made by their parents or grandparents, and they have been passed along one way or another. Whether we like it or not, the decisions and actions of each generation affect the decisions and actions of the next generation as that generation comes along. That's why we use the term generational. And just looking at our nation and the world, it seems to be automatic. And it seems that few, if any, have the knowledge that it needs to be broken or have the strength and desire to break the generationalism. It can be done, and we in the Church of God are showing that by living by God's ways. It is a shame. Generational is a scourge. It is a curse. But, you know, we talk a lot about God's laws. I read you one of the laws of the Iroquois Nation, but one of God's laws says that it will be, one of God's great laws says that there will be such a thing as generational, and it tells us why. And then it shows that it doesn't have to be if, and we'll talk about the if later. Let's look at God's great law. Not the great law of the Iroquois Indian Confederation, but the great law of the Creator of the universe in Exodus 20 and verse 3. Won't read the whole thing, just this verse. Exodus 20, verse 3, the first of the Ten Commandments says, don't have any other gods except me. Now you say, well, God is a little bit egotistical, isn't he? He doesn't like competition. He doesn't want any other gods. You know, in the nation today, our President Obama said, we are no longer a Judeo-Christian nation. We are a Buddhist nation. We are a Muslim nation. We are a Hindu nation. Because we have so many other gods among us, people are worshiping other gods, and it's just taken for granted that that's the way it ought to be. But when God chose Israel, he said, don't worship any other god other than me. Now, in truth, there are no other gods. Paul the Apostle explained that there are those in name, but not in reality. And then comes verse 4. He said, don't make yourself a carved image, likeness of anything in heaven or in the earth or in the waters beneath. Now, it isn't wrong to have a carved image, or shall we say an image. If you have a digital camera, you're snapping images all the time. You are carving out an image on that mirror, that window. And when you have it developed, you have a carved image right there to look at. So it isn't wrong, because you read the next verse and you'll see why. It isn't wrong to have an image, shall we say. I don't see any pictures in here. We have, you know, as you go to other churches, you'll see the picture of this long-haired Jesus right off the speaker stand. That's what happened when I was baptized long, long ago in a Baptist church. That was an image that someone had carved of what they thought Jesus looked like. It said, don't have any carved images. Then verse 5, and this is the key, don't bow down and worship it. Now, that could be a car, that could be a house, that could be a person, that could be a dollar bill. As they say, we say, in God we trust, but the dollar bill says, in this God we trust. Don't bow down and worship it. Now, why? What difference does it make? As I said, Mr. Obama feels that we're all headed in the right direction. We're just going under different names. And it seems to be that the general thinking now is they're all the same. And it doesn't make any difference which religion, that is, which God you're with, just so you're sincere with the one you're with. But God said, don't worship any other God than him. Now, he is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And if you read in Isaiah, it says in the millennium, all the nations will come up to Jerusalem to worship, not just worship, but they'll come to worship the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Allah won't be there. Vishnu won't be there. Quite a few others won't be there. So don't make a God out of an image and fall down and worship it. Why? Well, for starters, when you worship a false god, you're going to be given wrong information. The Japanese worshipped their emperors, and they were willing to give their life in a kamikaze fighter plane to please their god. The Muslims, so they say, and this is always bantered about and laughed at, that if they, especially for the men, if they set themselves off with a bomb to kill the pagans, then they have secured for them 70 virgins in their heaven. 70? I mean, one's enough. Why 70? But the point is, I think they're a little misled by their God. Wrong information, wrong guidelines, wrong direction, which ultimately becomes a wrong lifestyle. That's why it's wrong to worship another God. And believe you me, our direction, our decisions and our actions will influence the direction we go and the lifestyle of our own selves and of those who come after us. you will find why he said it is such a disastrous thing to do this. And it also shows that God shows that generationalism will follow. He said in verse 5, after saying, don't bow down to this God and worship it. Why? He said, because I'm the Lord your God. I'm the only eternal one. And it seems to say in the latter, well, the middle part of this verse, that God is this jealous God, and he fiendishly delights in heaping punishment on people. It seems to say this because it says, I'm a jealous God and I visit the iniquity, which means the lawlessness or the wrong living habits, the wrong decisions, the lifestyle that is wrong and contrary to God, the lifestyle that tramples all over the Sabbath, the holy days, God's laws, the goodness of God's laws. That's what the word iniquity means. He will visit, or there will be repercussions toward those who do trample all over God's laws. And then it says, the iniquities of the fathers are the ones that come before the children. Upon the children to the third and fourth generations. He says of those that hate him. Third and fourth. That's generational. When you imbibe the wrong information and you live it and your children see it, what do you think they're going to do? The young man whose father was an alcoholic, who turned into an alcoholic, when asked why, he said, what do you expect with an old man like I had for a father? It affected him. It affected his attitude. It affected his lifestyle. It affected him negatively, very negatively. And yet he didn't even know the reasons. Wrong information, wrong guidelines, wrong lifestyle. That's why it does make a difference. And God warned us in advance that if we live contrary to the proper rules, that's the way it would be. Generation after generation after generation. Wrong actions, wrong rules, wrong lifestyle will pass along to and cause side effects in the lives of others for 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 generations. Who knows how long? That's called generational. It never fails. It is almost an absolute. Now, it can be broken, but sometimes it takes 2 or 3 generations to finally escape from that. I watched Roots many years ago in the 70s when it first came out. Recently, we had purchased a video of that, and we watched it again, or at least I watched it again. And at the end of the movie, when slavery was abolished, the end of the Civil War, there's a man in there called Chicken George. And he was in Virginia when the war ended, and when it ended, he moved his family to Tennessee and had a farm. And it showed him one of the scenes that he gathered his family around him with the horse and the wagons, and he looked at them all, and he said, "We be free now." And I don't mean to make fun of the accent, but it was true, they were free from the slavery, from the influence of former generations and the lifestyle of former generations. We sometimes don't realize how much we are enslaved and don't even know it because of where we came from, to whom we were born, the decisions made by those people, the severity of the decisions of those people. As I said, it seems to say that God inflicts the damage, and he enjoys that, so some think. No, by living contrary to God's standards, people show their, shall we say, disrespect for God or their ignorance of God's ways. And what they don't realize is that they pass along their lifestyle to their children, because the children don't know any different. The home is our first teacher. Our father and our mothers are our first teachers. The school that we go to is our first teacher. The people that we live among are our teachers. And we learn, we copy, and we mimic. One older brother I have, now dead, used to chew and he spat on the floor. One day his little son was, he wasn't chewing tobacco, but he was doing something and he spit on the floor. I don't think his father liked that, but where do you think the kid learned it? We learn, right or wrong, good or bad, from those that we're born to in whose home we live and in this society. It's called the followers. Oh no, it's called following the followers. They don't know they're just following people who don't know, and they, the ones they're following, are following someone else who's following someone else who's following someone else. Somewhere along the line, we have to break the mold by taking control of our own life and being responsible for our own life and making sure we have the right knowledge and we're living by the right knowledge. Otherwise, we'll be passing along generationalism to our children in the wrong way. And I can see that in my own life since being in the ministry and in the Church of God and in the ministry, that there are things I did not understand about child rearing, and I passed it along to our sons. And I regret that. I'm sorry for that. And I ask God to help me in overcoming and changing it. Because each generation is influenced by what it sees at home, at school, and in this society. And we just read, God said it will affect children to the third and fourth generations, because the ones they're looking to are living by the wrong rules. They have a wrong lifestyle. It's generational, and it seems to be automatic. And very, very few seem to know how, if it's even possible from their viewpoint, to break that. Some would say, what I do is my business, as long as no one else is hurt. And I feel like laughing in their face. Not socially nice to do that, but I'm biting my lip, you know. It's just stupid to say, it's my business as long as no one else is hurt. They don't understand that they're hurting their children because the children are following their habits and will turn out as they have turned out, more than likely. They don't understand generationalism. It's a living law. Those who don't understand it have limited vision. That's what I call short-term view. They're thinking of the short term, not the long term. Others are affected after the fact. And both the giver and the receiver of that type of life both wonder why. And usually they say, in looking back, what happened? Why did that happen? What did I do? When we read the Bible and about the beginning of human beings, and you know there are actors and actresses that have their premier premier breakout, their premier act on stage at some fancy hotel or fancy movie house. They call that their grand premiere. There is a grand premiere in the Bible for human beings. You'll find it in Genesis. And act one of the grand premiere of the first human couple very profoundly illustrates this absolute principle of generationalism. And we'll see what I've been talking about. Let's go to Genesis 2, beginning in verse 16. Genesis 2 and verse 16. God took the man, that's 15, God commanded the man, in other words, he laid out the rules. God was the father, he is the creator, he's the boss, he's the president, the premier, the prime minister, and he said to his children, his creation, there are rules you'll need to learn. One of them is there's a broad latitude of many things that you have at your disposal. That was the good news. Of every tree of the garden you may freely eat. A lot that you can do. Except this one over here, it's a mixture. Leave it alone. If you don't leave it alone, you will have some difficulties in your life. It could even cause your death. It's not good for you. Well, in chapter 3, verse 6, you will find, and we tend to blame the woman, but as I've said before, it was a two-person act. When the woman saw the tree was good for food, how can you tell just by looking at it that it's good for food? Some apples now have been sprayed and they look bright and red and beautiful, but when you bite into them, they're like as hard as a rock. Or they can even be not so good inside, but they've been preserved on the outside. Sometimes you can't tell just by looking, but she had a limited view. She had a short-term view. She just looked at it and said, I don't see anything wrong with it. And then you will find, and she was also short on experience, she made the decision to eat the fruit. In other words, she challenged the corporate rules. And then she gave it to her husband, and he threw it away. I misread that, didn't I? No, he didn't throw it away. He said, thank you, honey, and he chomped onto it. He ate it also. Now, you'll find in the Bible that it says Eve was deceived, but Adam wasn't deceived, meaning he knew better. And he still did it. I can't remember if I said it here. I've said it in Columbus. That seems to be a trait about us men, including myself, that we as a man can do things knowing that it's not right or not best, not that it's an absolute sin, but it's something we probably shouldn't be doing, but we do it anyway. And when our wife finally finds out, she says, what, you mean you knew better and you did it anyway? It blows them away, but it doesn't seem to bother a man. I did it, so what? I see a little laughing going on among couples here. Struck a sore spot. She gave to her husband and he ate it anyway also. He made the decision. She didn't hold a gun to his head. And you know, God did not stop them from it. Now, you see in modern child rearing often, you see the father and mother, don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do that. They just keep saying, don't do that, but they don't ever do anything. Well, God said, don't do it, and then he left it free to them to do whatever they would do. If I had been there, I would have been looking around the corner, and as soon as they started to it, I would have said, no, you can't do that. But God didn't, because he was working with character development. She ate, and she gave to her husband. How far ahead do you think they were looking? Were they considering their children? grandchildren, great grandchildren? Had they ever heard the word generational? Did they know what they were dealing with? God's absolute laws. Did they know they were dealing with the creator of the universe? Had they ever heard the statement, what you plant, you will harvest? Other than themselves, who were they considering? How far into their family genealogy were they looking? And this one, and I hear this a lot in the day. If they had known the consequences, would they have made the same choice anyway? You've heard it say, the old man said, if I knew I was going to live this long, I'd have taken better care of myself. If they had known the consequences, would they have made the same choice? If they had known that all of mankind would be cut off from God by what they did. In Romans it says, by one man was all cut off. If they had known that, would they have made the same choice anyway? You know, as I said, people think that God fiendishly delights in heaping curses on them. God didn't have to do a thing. They did it themselves. They brought the wrong consequences on themselves. You know, asking the tough questions of one's own self and using long-term vision makes life go much better than the instant gratification. Now, they had instant gratification, but it wasn't what they wanted. Instant gratification is the result of a short-term view. Adam and Eve did not ask the tough questions, but they did use short-term vision. And all who followed them for 1,700 years were affected and had a changed life as a result of that one family decision. You can add them up in the book of Genesis about those that lived for 900 and 700 and all that. It's about 1,600 years till Noah. About 1,600 years, the generations got so bad, they all were drowned. That's awful. It's kind of like a row of dominoes. And you may have done that just to see it, because it's almost mesmerizing to hit one domino and see it hit the next and the next and the next, and it go. That's the way mankind was. Adam and Eve were the first domino, and they tilted and hit the next one, and the next, and the next, and the next. For 1,600 years, generationalism ruled. When you see Adam and Eve in the resurrection, are you going to say, did you shed any tears over that? And why did you do that? Do you think Adam and Eve ever shed any tears over the long-term consequences that came about because of the one decision that they made? One lousy little sugar-coated apple. Generationalism. There is a warning for us as Christians in the New Testament. We're warned about following in the way of Cain. Now that means don't be generational. Don't do what Cain did. It's called the way of Cain. Not the one act, but the way, the lifestyle. This example is given as a negative point to help us learn to love one another. Let's look in 1 John 3, verse 10, and we'll find the admonition to us as Christians about this generational thing. 1 John 3 and verse 10. It talks about not loving your brother. Verse 11, you'll find that one of the first company rules is that we should love one another. And it seems the Council of Elders of United keep bringing up this statement over and over and over and over and over again, that we learned and we're learning and we will learn that we haven't loved each other as we should. So they're admitting a fault of not learning to love one another. And the message says, we've heard from the beginning that we should love one another. And then verse 12 says, and loving one another means that we'll learn to think of the welfare of the other person, not just ourselves. And then it says in verse 12, not as Cain. He murdered his brother. And it says he murdered his brother because his works were not right and his brother's were. So there was envy and jealousy. He wasn't thinking of his own, of his brother, just of himself. You will find the story of that in Genesis 3. Genesis 3, verse 15. The aftermath of the eating of the apple or avocado or prune, or whatever it was they ate. The aftermath of that turned out this way. Genesis 3, verse 15 says, God said to Eve, I will put enmity or hostility between you and the woman. Oh, no, he's talking to the serpent at this time. I'll put enmity between you and the woman, Eve. And of course, we apply this to the church. It's spoken of as a woman. And between your children and her children. He will bruise your head. Now, just taking it at face value, he was talking to the serpent. But he was talking about Eve, that he, the son of this woman, Eve, will bruise your head, and you shall bruise his, the woman's son, you'll bruise his heel. We know, of course, it means spiritually. So, did Adam and Eve know about Jesus? We know that this meant Jesus. But I don't think they knew that meant Jesus. They thought that meant their child, the next child they would have, because one was murdered by the brother and the other one was sent off. So in chapter 4, verse 1, you will find that Adam knew his wife and she conceived and bore Cain. And she said, I have acquired a man from the Lord. Doesn't seem to be any specialty about that. But there are those translations of the Bible and commentaries that say, based on what God had said to the serpent and subsequently to her, her child would be this one that would bruise the head of the one that had caused the trouble. She conceived and bore Cain and said, I got it. This is the one. This is the child that is going to save us. And it says, then she bore again. It doesn't say she conceived again, so we assume from that that they were twins. And it was Abel. Then you'll find that they brought sacrifices. Abel brought of the fruit of the ground. And a sacrifice. Now, it doesn't say, you know, exactly why God was not pleased with Cain's offering, but maybe it could be that Abel, when it says Abel also, it could mean that he brought a sacrifice and he brought the fruit of the ground, showing that he was human and that he needed to be humble before God. All it says is God had respect to Abel's offering, and he did not to Cain. And you will find in verse 5 that it says, Cain was very angry. Apparently he had an anger problem. And God said, why are you angry? if you do well, you'll be accepted. And that's one of the hardest lessons to learn. You don't have to beat somebody. You just have to do the best you can and do it right, and you'll be fine. If you do well, you'll be accepted, won't you? And if you don't, then maybe you'll have to deal with sin and the consequences of sin. Well, that didn't satisfy Cain. He talked with Abel, and whatever was said, he rose up. It wasn't an accident. He deliberately killed his brother because he was jealous of his brother and he was angry at God. And that's why we're told in the New Testament, not as Cain did. He wasn't thinking of anybody else but himself. So we take from that, putting it all together, that Cain was a self-centered, egotistical individual, and he did not think of, nor maybe did he even care about, the consequences would come to others because of what he did. John said he was influenced when he did that. He listened to the wrong information. And when God said, "Where's your brother?" he lied to God. And you will find in verse 16, because of all of that, Cain went out from, he was sent out from the presence of God. And I think there are vast implications here. I don't know why it is, but in watching movies, we like to watch the mountain men. These men who were men, who lived in the backwoods, and they ate rabbits and snakes and possums and squirrels. And, you know, they took a bath every 6 months, whether they needed it or not. But they were men. But, you know, they always had to have a rifle that was made by somebody in civilization. They always had to have an axe made by someone in civilization. They always had to have something that was made by those who lived in the civilization more than just what the man had of his own hand. He was sent out to the backwoods, shall we say, or the Aussies call it out back. And out back down there a long time ago wasn't very good at all. And you'll find that he went out from the presence of God, meaning he didn't have contact with God. And when you lose contact with God, you lose a lot. You lose his law, you lose his protection, you lose his blessing. So Cain married, and said he knew his wife, had to be one of his sisters, and she bore Enoch. And then you find the genealogy went on down and down and down, and you'll find that one of them, Lamech, had two wives, and he'd killed someone. And in verse 24, if Cain is avenged sevenfold, Lamech will be 77-fold. Well, it goes back to Adam and Eve, and they had intimacy, and she bore a son, called his name Seth, and he had a son, they named him Enos. And then it says, in a nondescript way, the latter part of verse 26, at that time, people began to call on the name of the Lord. Oh, well, it sounds like they were coming back to God. But other translations and commentaries say, at that time, they began to call themselves by the name of God. And remember, this was talking about the children that had come along. It appears that Cain thought he was above the law, or shall we say, growing up and being taught, if indeed that's what happened, that he was going to solve the problem for mankind. He would challenge and take on this serpent, and that he was the man. Maybe he grew up thinking that he was God. And you find that men began to call on the name of God, which could be they called on, but which God were they calling on? Or they put it in their name, something that implied they were God. You see a lot of it today. The names that have Muhammad in it or other names for God in their name. You'll find that, then you find in chapter 5, you skip that because that's of the book of the genealogy of Adam. And then in chapter 6, verse 1, you will find that the beginning of it getting worse and worse and worse in those 1600 years. And in verse 3, God said, I'm not going to put up with this forever. I know they're human. I know they're flesh and blood, but we'll give them a certain amount of time. And then you find comes the flood. 1600 years from one family to the next, generationalism. And they had to be wiped off the face of the earth because of the way it had come down to. Well, all of the examples so far have been of gloom and doom. That's negativism. We ought not be negative people. But it seems like sometimes we are, and that's all that people can think about is the bad things. That's why I emphasize good news means just that, good news. There's another side to this great law of God, and it's a positive side. And I think this positive side is important for the building of our faith today. Let's go back to Exodus 20, verse 5, where I skipped over something, and I did it deliberately because I didn't want to blend the subject at that time. But I want to specify or speak specifically about this other part of Exodus 20, verse 5, says that there would be penalties down to the third and fourth generation. Exodus 20 and verse 5, it said to the third and fourth generation. Then verse 6, but, and you heard it said, the most important words are those that come after the word, but. But, God said, I will show mercy to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. Thousands will be blessed who live and teach the right rules. And it shows by the word thousands, this can be and is generational also, but it's in a positive manner with good results. I know that we know that God has to call, but if we live by an exemplary, if we live an exemplary life, and if we teach the proper ways, who knows how much that will influence our children, and in addition, our grandchildren and our great grandchildren in health, wealth, conversion. Timothy was a third generation. His grandmother was in the faith. His mother was in the faith. And Timothy was in the faith. It doesn't say anything about his father except that he wasn't in the church. Apparently, his mother married outside the Jewish clan and the faith. And Timothy was, you might say, a mama's boy. Now, most boys don't like to be called a mama's boy. Them's fighting words. I'm a man. I'll show you with my fist. Timothy showed that he was a man by living by God's ways. You don't have to prove your masculinity. It will be shown. So if we live by these rules of the corporation, shall we say, properly, we will be generating good things in our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren, and it will be generationalism from the positive viewpoint. And that's the most important thing. So how far ahead do we look? Just to our own life? How about our children? Grandchildren? Great-grandchildren? When we make decisions, do we think about or have in mind our future generations? Think of those women who took thalidomide in the 50s, was it? Sad-looking faces that they produced. Beautiful little children that had flippers for arms. All because of what their mother did. She didn't know any better. No one told her the consequences of taking thalidomide. So how far ahead do we look? Do we think of our children? If I take steroids, will they affect my children? If I use drugs, will they affect my children? If I have a child outside of marriage, will that affect my family and my children? If I don't provide for my children properly, will that affect them? If I do not nourish or nurture my children, will it affect their lives? We have to think. It involves what's called generationalism. It follows one generation after the other. So the positive thing is we need to think about the promises, because when we have enough positive reasons, we will do it. We do things because of reasons. And when we have enough positive reasons, we'll probably do it. And think about the promise God made. He said, he promised, I will show mercy to thousands of those who love me. And I remind God often of that statement. God, you blessed Esau even though he hated his brother. You blessed Ishmael even though he taunted Isaac. Remember my children. Think about those wonderful promises made to thousands of those who love God. Abraham is called the father of the faithful for a reason. Abraham was thinking more of others, or thinking as much of others than just himself. Let's look in Hebrews 11, verse 17. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 17 says, by faith, when he was tested. In other words, he had a firm, positive conviction that led him to do what he did. In verse 10, you will find this about Abraham and of his long-term view of life. He, Abraham, waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Well, he was looking thousands of years into the future. The New Jerusalem is after the thousand-year millennial rule, the second resurrection time. Who knows how many years that is? Abraham was back, well, it's been 2,000 since Christ, 2,000 to Abraham about it. So we're looking at 5,000 years or more that Abraham was looking into the future. Now, you know, after 4,990 years, you think, oh, boy, give up on it. It's not going to be in 5,000 years almost. But he looked for that city. He had a long-term view. And you know something? Our lives, physically and spiritually, are enriched because of what he did. We live in Israel. God blessed our nation because of what Abraham did. It is generational in a positive way. I think Christ is the ultimate example who looked beyond the moment of time in which he found himself. You'll find in Matthew 26 and verse 36... a statement or two made by Jesus, very powerful. And it gives us an insight into how we can guarantee that we will make better decisions. Matthew 26 and verse 36. Jesus came to Gethsemane and he said to the disciples, you sit there, I'm going to go over here and talk to God. Sometimes we need to talk with someone before we make our decision. He wanted to talk to God about the plan of having sons and daughters in the family of God. And you can find what he said in verse 42. This was the second time he said, if this cup cannot pass from me unless I drink it, all right, that's what we'll do. He knew that someone had to make it possible for all people to be saved, brought into the family of God. And he knew that it was his shall we say, it fell to his lot to be the man. And he said, if that's the only way, fine, we'll do it that way, because I know that there will be more brothers and sisters in the family of God. I will make that choice because of them. Had he not made it, you wouldn't be sitting in a chair today in the United Church of God. If that's the only way, then that's what we will do. You will find in Hebrews 12 and verse 2, a side benefit to Jesus personally that we can learn from in making the right choices that involve other people, that may involve our not enjoying the moment so much. Hebrews 12 and verse 2. And I'm sure you've experienced this in certain ways. It says, we should look to Jesus, who for the joy that was set before him. What do you mean joy? He knew he was going to be beaten beyond understanding by the Romans. Joy? Well, he was looking beyond to the resurrection of the dead, when people would be raised from flesh and blood or whatever was left of it to become a spirit being, to live in the family of God with him and the Father forever. That ought to cause a smile. That ought to cause a smile on some faces. This shows that we can have joy in knowing that we had a part in helping our children to be successful, our grandchildren to be successful. I think that's especially, well, it's important for both, but a man should have joy and great satisfaction in knowing that he played a part in the success of his family and of the others around him who were positively affected by his or our actions. So, we should not be like Cain, thinking only of ourselves, but thinking of other people. We should be like the Iroquois, who put in their law that when we make a decision, we should think of seven generations in the future. So how far ahead do we look? Well, whether we believe it or not, what we do, how we live our life, the decisions that we make, will affect those generations who come after us. The implied meaning of generationalism usually is negative, but as I showed you, it can be positive, and that's the wonderful aspect of it. If we do think of the generations before us, and we make those decisions because of them, then we also will profit greatly from that. I want to close the sermon today, message today, with this poem written by Will Drumgoole. It's called The Bridge Builder. You may have heard it before. The Bridge Builder. I've never been good at reading poems, so I'll try to read it the best I can. An old man going along the highway came at the evening cold and gray to a chasm, vast, deep, and wide, through which was flowing a sullen tide. The old man crossed in the twilight dim. The sullen stream had no fears for him, but he turned when safe on the other side and built a bridge to span the tide. Old man, said a fellow pilgrim near, you're wasting strength with building here. Your journey will end the evening day. Never again will you pass this way. You've crossed the chasm deep and wide. Why build you a bridge at the evening tide? The builder lifted his old gray head. Good friend, in the path I have come, he said, there follows after me today a youth whose feet must pass this way. This chasm has been naught for me, To that fair-haired youth may a pitfall be. He too must cross in the twilight dim. Good friend, I'm building the bridge for him.